Hello, listeners. Welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. My name is Tracy Morgan, your devoted host. And today we are very pleased to have with us Dr. Orna Ophir, and we'll be discussing with her her book On the Borderland of Madness, Psychosis, Psychoanalysis, and Psychiatry in Postwar USA, published by Routledge, 2015. A few words about Dr. Ophir before we get into the interview. She's a clinical psychologist and a practicing psychoanalyst in private practice here in New York City. She holds a PhD in the history of science. She's an adjunct associate professor at the Humanities Center at Johns Hopkins University. She is also an adjunct clinical assistant professor of psychology in psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College and on the faculty at the Institute for Psychoanalytic Education. Congrats, I didn't know this. affiliated with the School of Medicine at NYU. Among her publications are the book we'll be speaking to her with her about today, and she also has a chapter in the book on love and forgiveness. And currently, she's working on a second book project entitled Klein in America, The Marginalization of Melanie Klein in American Psychoanalysis. So welcome, Orna Ophir. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So every person that we speak to in New Books in Psychoanalysis, we ask this first question to get things started. And it's a very simple question. What drove you to write this book?
So I'm happy to be with you finally. It's been a long time in the making.
We've been working on it, yeah.
Yes. Good. Yeah. So the short answer is a sense of urgency, you know, a feeling of a loss of a significant part of my professional life and the urge to learn everything I can about it so I can repair it or make a difference. Mm-hmm. The long answer is, to begin with, I never thought I'd write a book. So when I was a kid, I wanted to fly airplanes like my father. So I did a lot of science in school. But then I realized that what I really liked and was actually good at was art. So when I was done with my army service, I thought I should pursue my passion and went to Bezalel Academy of Art in Jerusalem. And I studied there for a year. And found that while I was making art, I was challenged, not to say attacked, by all kind of ideas and emotions that were both fascinating and frightening. So somehow I fell back on my old training in the sciences, and I went to study psychology. Mm-hmm. But while I was doing it, I found that I'm mostly interested in pathology, in psychopathology, and in psychoanalysis. So, but I did feel that there was something about the studies themselves that was too theoretical, and I needed some real-life experience to learn from. So when I was a sophomore undergraduate student, I began to volunteer in a psychiatric hospital that was known for its psychoanalytic orientation. And I was so fascinated by what I saw there, you know, by the behavior and the language and the gesture, you know, the world that these patients live in, or that what I, at least what I was imagining that they live in. And but also by the way that the staff members were thinking about these people. So in case conferences, in the grand rounds, even in just everyday conversation. So I stayed there for the rest of my undergraduate year, and I think this was part of probably the most important part of my schooling. And it was a very special school for me. It was the beginning of the 90s, and out of seven heads of departments in the hospital, five were psychoanalysts in the Israeli Psychoanalytic Society. It's an old society that was established by Max Eidington in 1934. And even the director of the hospital was a Jungian psychoanalyst.
Amazing, right?
Yes, it was. It was like a different world. It was a fascinating group of patients and a very, very solid group of analysts that I was so lucky to be in touch with. And you have to imagine that these analysts were working in a public setting. So they were treating psychotic people, mainly schizophrenic patients, who came from all walks of life. In Israel, there are no, at least there were no, I don't know what happened lately, Israel is being Americanized gradually.
Yeah,
but
rapidly, yeah.
Rapidly. So at least when I was working, there were no private psychiatric hospital in Israel. So basically, this was a place where you could see rich people and poor people, Orthodox Jews and secular people, educated people and people who had no education of whatsoever, old people, young people, soldiers that had the crisis during their army service. And each of them had their own psychotic world, and each of them was discussed very seriously by this remarkable and very committed group of analysts. So when I went to graduate school to become a clinical psychologist, I returned to this hospital, Shalvata Mental Hospital, first for an externship and later for an internship. And I was in a ward that it was an open ward with the head of was Dr. Ilan Travis. He was a student of Harold Searles. So when he was a young psychiatrist, he came to Chestnut Lodge for a fellowship, and he was very influenced by Searles. So after I graduated, I came back to work at the hospital. Now as a specialist, it was the early 2000s. So it's basically only something like 12 years after I began my schooling there. But when I returned, I noticed that there was only one psychoanalyst left in this whole institution. The rest have retired, and no new psychoanalyst was hired. And also there was no longer this kind of conversation, you know, this kind of discourse that was used to speak about patients, about therapists, about what is happening in the room. So I felt that we were now somehow working for psychopharmaceutical companies.
Right.
There was a lot of clinical trials going on in the hospital, new drugs, and a lot of biological language. There was a project of deep brain stimulation, and and it was completely the discourse of the brain taking over the story of the mind.
Right.
So I decided that it's a too big of a loss for me.
Yeah.
And I wanted to study what happened there, what happened during this decade. And since I was a clinician by then, I had to look for training as a historian. And I wanted to be, a historian of this specific field. So, and it was also important for me to have an intellectual community that would support this project. And I was very lucky to find my, what we call in Israel, Dr. Vater, it's the advisor, Professor Joseph Bruna, who is himself a historian of psychoanalysis. And I started to write this book at the Cohen Institute for the History and Philosophy of Science and Ideas. And basically, this mentorship and this community was what allowed me to, for 7 years, to do this, to write this book, to do the research. And as a young student, I worked as a journalist, so the writing was pretty much not a problem. But the big challenge was the shift from being a clinician to becoming a historian. And this required, you know that as somebody who've been through this training, but it required many years of training. And I feel that it's still, you know, I still continue this training to this very day.
Yeah. Wow. It's very moving. I'm just thinking about you yourself embody, you know, you lived through the change. I mean, you know, you're not, you know, an old person. You're, you know, a clinician for, 20 some odd years, but you actually, where you started and then where you came back, you went back home and it was as if the house had been burned down.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, so I could understand that, trying to see how you went from a world that really engaged you to a world where it was probably a lot less engaging when you returned to the hospital. If people weren't working, if your passion was psychoanalysis and everyone was doing, you know, as they were doing here at, you know, at a psychiatric institute, you know, all the brain studies, like on schizophrenia, that was it, you know. So
yeah,
it's a moving tale because it's personal.
Yes.
Very personal. So in reading this book, it's clearly, to my mind, it was clearly, I mean, I know Orna, right? And you know, we're friendly and, you know, we travel in a, you know, a pack of psychoanalysts who are friends. And, but I, you know, so as I'm reading this book, I'm having this experience of thinking, I'm also trained as an historian and as an analyst. And I'm thinking, you know, it fascinates me, the clinical mind and the historical mind, and what is the relationship between the two. I always would say I do history with a capital H, with a small H. You know, I do two kinds of history. And there's no doubt this is the work of a clinician, to my mind, because the way in which you end the book, which is fantastic, you create an emotional experience that it sort of offers a really uncomfortable, in some ways, interpretation that is evocative, which we may get to as we speak. But I want to ask you, how would you describe, you know, how does your work as a clinician, what impact does it have on your thinking or your work as an historian?
So, you know, it's Paul Ricoeur in his in his narrative function, writes that history is a tale told about the past in the present for present purposes. And I think that this is also what we do as analysts, as clinicians. Somehow we're meeting the past in the present, and we try to find all these missing parts of the story. And we know that they are not really lost. We know that they are transcribed somewhere, and in symptoms on the body, acting out, inhibition. And I think, or at least I hope, that being a very specific type of clinician, so I was trained in the Kleinian tradition, that I'm working with this kind of, you know, Freud's hermeneutic of suspicion. Mm-hmm. So, and we find it in many histories, in the Marxist tradition and Foucault's genealogy. But it's rather than somehow finding a moment in history or reconstructing the past, I'm trying more to find some hidden patterns, if you want. Mm-hmm. And I do find some kind of parallels that I'm, you know, it's not fully elaborated in my mind, but it's an intuition, or it's still in the stage of intuition, that the paradigms that I'm looking for when I do a historian work are somewhat like the fantasies that that we find in patients, that there is some underlying thoughts of scientists, or in my case, you know, analysts, that are shaping the way they're thinking. And we see it also as clinician when we work with patients, that there are unconscious fantasies that are shaping the patient's thoughts, their dreams, their symptoms, their defenses, their object relations. Mm-hmm. So as a as a historian of scientists or thinkers and their ideas, because this is what I do, I find myself somehow following the fantasies that my scientists, my analysts are entertaining about their object that they study. Mm-hmm. And, you know, during the controversial discussions in London during World War II, between the Anna Freudians and the Melanie Kleinians, Marjorie Burley, who is from the enemy camp, from the Anna Freudian, I'm joking, but yes. She remarked that that she criticized the Kleinian, and she said that if they equate mental functions with their subjective interpretation of it, then psychoanalysis could not claim to be more scientific than the Chinese peasant who interprets the eclipse as the sun being swallowed by a dragon. Mm-hmm. And Paula Hyman, who was a great supporter of Klein at that time, replied that psychoanalytic science is not like astronomy. It's not like we're studying the natural world and, you know, like we study the solar system. But it's precisely the mind of the Chinese peasant as it creates this kind of theory that we study. And this is what I do as a historian. I want to know how this kind of knowledge develops in the mind of my peasants. And my peasants are psychoanalysts. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, what I'm trying to do is to expose what is going on in the mind of the subject that I'm studying. And this could be patients and it can be analysts. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if we go back to the idea of writing history with this suspicion, like with this hermeneutic of suspicion, then it's always also important for me to keep in check that my suspicion about what is hidden in there doesn't turn into paranoia, meaning that, you know, I won't be looking for what I'm already convinced that I would find.
Right.
So, you know, Eve Sedgwick has this idea of paranoid reading and more reparative reading. So I'm trying to do the more reparative one.
Right. I mean, I was thinking, what did you find? I mean, in doing this research, which is, you know, largely a sort of content analysis, I would say, you know, as working as an intellectual historian of some of the major psychoanalytic journals and also the Schizophrenia Bulletin and some others. I was wondering, as you were doing all this reading and sorting through, you know, all these ideas over the course of, you know, whatever, 60 some odd years, what surprised you? Did anything like when you're talking about, you know, rather than writing what it is you think you know, because you did live through something.
Yes.
Know? So what is, did anything surprise you in terms of what you learned as you were doing the research that you didn't expect to see?
I guess that what surprised me were the many American psychoanalysis that I found. So when I came to this research, I thought, you know, I have one thought collective. I have one group that I'm trying to figure out what they were doing, how they destroyed my hospital, and I found that there were many colors and many different groups within this specific group. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned that I was reading the kind of publication that I was using, this kind of professional journals. Mm-hmm. And in an informal incident, you asked me about why not speaking to these people.
Mm-hmm. Right, well, not my oral history.
Yes, well, Why was I? Maybe I was paranoid enough not to meet them, just to sit in libraries. And I was thinking about it because it's a good idea, and you know there are many stories to tell, and there are many ways to tell this story. And I thought that you know your idea to perhaps be surprised by meeting people. Mm-hmm. And actually listen to their own stories was a beautiful idea, and could have, you know, created a great story.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's, you know, my background as a historian is in the historian of medicine, and
yes.
More of a social and cultural historian. So I was, you know, as I was reading this, I was like, what would it be like if we could find these some of these people and really get them talking and see what were people, you know, there's what people write, and then there's what they're actually doing.
Right.
And so what we understand sort of the official discourse and how it changed. And this book is very powerful in that you can really, I mean, Orna does very, very close reading of the ways in which the discourse changed, every twist and turn it took on the
yes.
road, you know, from the conflicted, you know, the sort of the ego defect to like a brain disorder, right?
Right.
But it's always just I was just thinking, what would it be, you know, what would it be like to, you know, to get somehow like people at Riggs, you know, people
yes.
who, you know, I mean, I know, you know, Anna, you know,
mm-hmm.
Silver, and, you know, from
yes.
Chestnut Lodge, et cetera.
Yes.
It would just
yes.
be, it would be.
Anne Louise.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I did, you know, I was very much inspired by Ludwig Fleck, who was a Polish-Israeli microbiologist, basically, but who long before Thomas Kuhn, you know, and his idea of paradigm shifts, and long before Foucault's ideas of the episteme, he developed this idea of thought collectives. And this was basically the first system of a sociology of science.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because he has this idea that, you know, our scientific facts are social construct. So it's not, you know, people perceive and think differently,
mm-hmm.
but that these differences are concerning groups more than the individual.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote about thought collectives,
mm-hmm.
and he saw cognition as a collective activity.
Mm-hmm.
So he was interested in not in the individual practitioner,
right.
but in this community of people who were, you know, by exchanging ideas, by maintaining an intellectual interaction, you know, they transform ideas, but not in their own heads, but also, and perhaps first of all, in this interpersonal space.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, he wasn't so much interested in the individual scientist, say how Anne Louise Silver got to know a phenomena like Pete.
Mm-hmm.
But he would say that individual X, let's say individual Anne Louise Silver from Chestnut Lodge, got to know this Pete, this phenomenon of psychosis in a specific style of thought, which is also one of his concept, and in a specific epoch. So it doesn't matter who this X individual would be. This individual who I might indeed have interviewed, but it's more the thought collective
mm-hmm.
that he or she belonged to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was interested in the ways this kind of body of knowledge developed as a result of the exchange of ideas between a group of people. So it's more this thought collectives as they are formed in this kind of exchange in these specific publications.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the thing that surprised me. You asked me about the surprise. Mm-hmm. That I saw that these different psychoanalytic journals are represented very different thought styles.
Yes, and what is really clear is, or part of the story you tell, is that Americans who publish in JAPA versus Americans who are publishing in the IJP, it's that the many analysts, as the sort of the brain, ideas about, as you call it, the neo-Semitic, took hold. Many American analysts who were uncomfortable with that, with the ascendance of that way of thinking, it seems that they turn to Europe and publish more in the IJP.
Right.
Yeah. So I mean, it was very
right.
You really felt, and I really felt for them. I was like, they're like, well, I can't stay around in my home.
Yeah.
I can't
yeah.
stay home anymore. Right? You couldn't go back to the hospital. It was different. These right. Americans,
right.
It's like
yeah.
they're just searching for a home.
Yeah, a port in the storm. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So let's talk about, I had never heard this term. I mean, I don't know, where I've been. Maybe it's popular and I'm just adamant.
No.
Or maybe it's just your term. I don't know. But you refer to the neo-Semitic revolution. And so
right.
I want you to sort of let the listeners know what is this concept, and to educate the listeners about what makes it a revolution.
Yeah. So, as I said, as a historian, what I'm trying to do is not only follow the debates or the conflicts in the profession, but also to put it in a larger context. In the whether it's political or economical or the big pharmas, the DSM, the decade of the brain, and I'm trying to make intervention in this debate, and this neo-somatic revolution is something that I came up with. Which refers to
your word. Okay.
I hope so. I've never heard it before. I used it, so I think I came up with it because
and English is not your first language, and you invented a new word.
Yes.
In English. I love it.
No, perhaps it's there. So I cannot. I cannot take ownership of the term, but the idea that I had of a neo-Semitic revolution had to do with, the kind of repetition that I see, just like as we spoke, as clinician, we see this kind of repetition, the same we see in intellectual discourses and in practices. And the one thing I found while I was doing my research is that there is a repetition in American psychiatry of this conflict, of this constant debate. And Tanya Luhrmann wrote this anthropologist, wonderful anthropologist, has one of her books titled is Of Two Minds, and it's about psychiatry. So that there is always the struggle between seeing the problem and the remedy of the psychotic patient as located either in the mind or in the brain, or if you want, either in the psyche or in the soma. So, and the pendulum constantly shifts back and forth. But American psychiatry began with moral treatment. It began with psychological treatment. It was trying to avoid the old somatic remedies of Hippocrates and Galen, that were based on the humoral theory. So instead of cupping and purging and bleeding, they offered somewhat a more enlightened treatment, more psychosocial. And it came with an emphasis on a more humane way of seeing the patient. So not seeing the patient as a body, as a wild animal who has lost her reason, but as someone who needs to learn gradually how to take responsibility. So it was not as if the old somatic treatment was completely gone, but it dramatically changed during the early 19th century from, you know, weeping and beating and using all kind of chemicals to an emphasis on the body, but in a very different way. You know, they would make sure that the patient ate healthily and that they were walking and that they were being active with gardening or sewing. And more importantly, they were being psychologically understood and were in an environment that was therapeutic. You know, Kirkbride plan of these beautiful asylums in the countryside with big gardens and water. But this was a beautiful project that where this kind of non-somatic tradition, traditional treatment was offered. But it grew enormously. So the population in this asylums grew in a way that would not allow for this kind of psychosocial treatment to continue. They were, by the end of the 19th century, they were overcrowded, underfunded, and American psychiatry needed to completely transform itself and the way it treated the insane. And since they were seen by their fellow physicians and mainly the neurologists as administrators or managers of the insane, they back then they were even called superintendent.
Right.
And they were, you know, neurologists devalue them, saying that, you know, their only worries were gardening and plumbing and heating. So they needed somehow to align themselves with what was considered science and progress. So they needed to start to think in terms of, you know, diagnosis and treatment that would resemble the more established medical science and practices. So during the first few decades of the 20th century, as part of this effort, you know, to become more medical, more scientific, psychiatry also introduced some of the most horrific, radical somatic treatments right. that the profession would ever known, and you know, in a bizarre way, they also earned two Nobel prizes for them. But we saw, you know, fever therapies, you know, caused by malaria. There was Henry Cotton in the Trenton Insane Asylum yeah. Hospital that was removing teeth and tonsils and ovaries and whatever, because, you know, the thought was that there was some infection lurking somewhere in the body. And there were all the shock therapies, so insulin, metrazole, and then ECT, and lobotomy, which is the second Nobel Prize. So this was the old somatic psychiatry. Right. So this is why I designated from the neo-somatic. And it's also important to say that while this happened in psychiatry, so this kind of somatic, radical somatic treatment, there was also a development of dynamic psychiatry. So the other part of it, which Nathan Hale writes beautifully about in his two volumes, was that, you know, the other way psychiatrists would find their way out of these asylum was dynamic psychiatry, which was the American version of psychoanalysis in psychiatric institutions. Mm-hmm. It was a more eclectic, more pragmatic kind of psychoanalysis with, you know, Adolf Meyer here from Hopkins and William Allenson White from Washington and the Manningers and later in Kansas. But this kind of you have this somatic and this psychodynamic, these two minds. But after the war, after World War II, these radical somatic treatments were harshly criticized. So most of them were discontinued. But in 1954 began what I call the new somatic revolution. So so it began with the introduction of Thorazine, the neuroleptic drug that was seen in psychiatry as, you know, the cheapest, most humane, effective treatment of psychosis. And it was part of a larger revolution that was initiated by John F. Kennedy with the New Frontier. And it followed the deinstitutionalization and, you know, the community psychiatry.
Right.
So what I try to show how this revolution in the sense of, you know, changing, shifting paradigm happened during the four decades that I cover. And how, you know, this kind of very medical view of psychoanalysts shifted with the shift in psychiatry.
Right. I mean, because we, you know, you think about the birth of psychoanalysis, you know, in America, and it's a medical forceps, a C-section, you know, but it's a very medicalized birth in that, you know, to be an analyst, one had to be an MD. And so in this book, you sort of weave back and forth like the tension that's at the very heart of that marriage. And this book is really also about a divorce, I think.
Right.
It's like, it's right. The, like you begin to see like the unraveling and you're cheating on me with, you know, with a neurologist. What are you doing? So, you know, I wanted to ask if you could imagine, you know, so here you are, you're when you're working on this book or before you were working on this book, you're working in Israel, you don't know a lot about the American psychoanalytic scene, you know, and then you start to do all this reading and you, as you said, you were surprised how much, like the, how many different schools of thought and all that was going on. And yet, you know, you know, the ways in which medicine and the medicalization of psychoanalysis has come to sort of, I don't know, how would you say, it sort of destroyed itself. I mean, there's a destruction at the heart of that marriage. But what if we were to imagine, had American, if we could even say, but had American psychoanalysis not started off, medicalized, what do you imagine the treatment of psychosis would look like in America today?
So I think it's a complicated story. Somehow, you know, we needed this. I think this marriage was needed. and I'm probably going to say something unpopular, but I think we should reconsider the ex, whether it was such a bad relationship. But you know, in, I have this chapter in the book, which I entitled Raven in White Coats, rephrasing Freud's quote that American and psychoanalysis were so ill-adapted that it was as though a raven were to put on a white shirt. Freud loved the American.
Yeah.
But he had, I think he had a very conflictual relationship to them and to schizophrenia. So it was both of them. But in this chapter, I show how, on the one hand, the medicalization of American psychoanalysis was psychoanalysts' royal road to the motherland of psychiatry, so to psychiatric hospital. Mm-hmm. So it was in these hospitals, basically, because of medicine, that these analysts were offered the opportunity to observe and to treat severely psychotic patients. But on the other hand, being part of this medical profession completely shaped the identity of American psychoanalysis. And, you know, whatever happened in psychiatry had an effect on psychoanalysis in this country. Paul Rosen, who was wrote the book about the historiography of psychoanalysis, said that, and I think Edith Kurzweil also mentioned it, or she had a similar idea in her book, The Freudians, that each country creates the Freud it needs.
Yeah.
So the psychoanalysis that is suitable for the culture. So in France, it was, and still is, it's a very intellectual Freud. In Germany and in some South American countries, it's a very political Freud. And in America, it is a very medicalized Freud.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was this kind of this relationship, you know, there was a codependency, if you want, because psychiatry needed psychoanalysis as a way out of the asylums. They needed some kind of a science, some kind of a theory, and some kind of a technique. And psychoanalysis needed psychiatry as a way to legitimize the profession. But what these strange bedfellows in this, if you want, marriage of convenience, as Maxwell Gittelson once said, they gave birth to a very specific child, you know, to this eclectic and pragmatic dynamic psychiatry that was practiced in institutions with very severely ill patients.
Right.
So yes, you know, if we go back to your question, everything that happened in American psychiatry affected psychoanalysis. So it's hard to think about American psychoanalysis without its relationship to psychiatry.
Yeah.
And especially when it comes to schizophrenic patients, because they were always the paradigmatic patients of psychiatry, unlike the neurotic that were, you know, the patients of psychoanalysis. So it would be hard to think.
Right. It is hard. I was like, wow, what if I found myself reading the book, going, I wonder, gosh, it's so incredible, like the back and forth. And like, it's sort of like, you know, you put your hand through a window by accident and you have to pull it back out. Oh, hello.
Sorry.
It's okay. We're live.
We're alive and well.
We're live, and this is a labor of love, New Books in Psychoanalysis. All kinds of real things happen. In fact, my neighbors are now coming home, and the door will open. You'll hear the door opening and closing in my building. It's really like, you know, I was saying, it's sort of like your hand goes through the window, and you have to pull it back out without hurting yourself. And it's like, look at and in a sense, what happened with the treatment of psychosis, you know, it tells the story of this, you know, what this divorce is.
Yes.
You can view it through the prism, and the book very much so does, of thinking about the treatment of psychosis. I
would just maybe say one more thing that when they finally got the divorce, these two professions, schizophrenia was left to psychiatry. So they took this child and the new babe of psychoanalysis was the borderline patient.
That's right. Absolutely. I mean, and it's really, I mean, I feel like that's the moment when I became a clinician, right around that time when that was happening, and probably yourself as well. And you're wondering, is this patient a borderline? Is this patient, do we call this patient a borderline? But I think the patient is psychotic. Oh, you know, well, I have to call her a borderline in order to work with her. to legitimize that I can actually see this person in my private practice without them, you know, having to interface with a psychiatrist.
Right.
You know.
And this is also the moment of the late 80s, but still with the effect of the DSM-3.
Yep.
Where we had to suddenly say, you know, what exactly this patient is suffering from, and you know, with our needing to deal with this, you know, emperor's new clothes, as I called it.
Totally. I mean, I remember I used to have to have patients who I understood to be psychotic, but who were not previously diagnosed by a psychiatrist as such. But oh, and I would always have to get the permission of a psychiatrist to treat them in my private practice. It was considered like, you know, due diligence that you get the psychiatrist to say this person can benefit from a talking therapy. And without that, I would have some supervisor say, I can't supervise you on this case if you don't get the psychiatrist to approve. Right. And, you know, talk about cumbersome you know, and sort of burdensome. And then, of course, to tell the patient, you need to go see it. You need to go elsewhere in order to come back to be with me.
Right. And I think what I found, because, you know, my anger was at, you know, the DSM, the insurance companies, you know, all this management of psychiatry, but and the big pharmas. But what I found when I it's one more surprise that I had was that that during this time that. And perhaps it's because of the history of the relation between psychiatry and psychoanalysis. This shift, this move from Freud to Kraepelin, or from the mind to the brain, or from, you know, what is behind the symptom, as Menninger taught us, to what we see, like what are the list of unambiguous observable symptoms.
Right.
That the same thing happened in psychoanalysis. So it's not as if it was only external, but in psychoanalysis, what I found, even though I cannot say it again about, I cannot say anything about American psychoanalysis as such. And the one thing I always liked was one of my favorite colleagues, now at Cornell, Ted Shapiro, who wrote back then, you know, that with all psychoanalyst excitement about, you know, this shift from the what is behind, what is hidden, to what is there, what we see, was happening not only in the DSM, but also with all these brain scans, right? So he would say that, you know, even if we could somehow see how the brain lights up when somebody hates
broccoli.
You know, exactly. So he said, okay, but we will never know whether it's like, you know, a deep, long hatred to a mother or a dislike to broccoli.
Right.
But he was not the majority. There were many psychoanalysts at that time that And the analysts who were invested in schizophrenia that began to see schizophrenia as a genetic biological disorder. You know, they saw it as nothing that psychoanalytic treatment can help, except with, you know, some kind of supportive therapy. And at the same time, they saw borderline disorder as something that is caused by you know, by the environment or development circumstances, so, you know, suitable for psychoanalytic study and treatment. Right. So I saw within psychoanalysis, within their writing, that they their criticism, severe criticism of anyone and everyone who claimed to successfully treat psychotic patients with psychoanalysis. And when I say everyone, it's, you know, Kleinians, but also the Washington School of Psychiatry, so the Chestnut Lodge generation from Rahman, Searles, even Hartman and his writing about schizophrenia and aggression. So they were somehow staying within the psychiatric establishment as psychoanalysts, but not thinking psychoanalytically about psychotic patients.
Right. They were sort of handing them over rather than claiming them, saying, okay, we'll give you this, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like a card game. All right, I'll you know, raise you five, you know.
Yes.
If you let me live, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you have a couple more minutes, because we're almost
at, I have.
Okay, good, because I there's something else that I really want you to talk about. So So you suggest, so here's Orna coming to America, reading about all these different American, you know, schools of psychoanalysis, getting more and more familiar, and she encounters this sort of, you know, huge relational turn that is, you know, begins to take hold with Mitchell and Greenberg's publication, book on object relations. I forget the year, that was 83 or something. Anyway,
yes.
You know, so we have in the book, you seem to be suggesting that following the relational turn, many American analysts became very interested in ideas about, you know, sort of the psychotic core, or psychotic aspects of functioning, or psychotic parts of the otherwise neurotic individual, or, you know, however it might be put, but not so much interested in treating people with psychosis. You're actually, you do a whole review of psychoanalytic dialogues, and it was very eye-opening to me. I wasn't surprised per se, but I was like, wow, that's really, they really aren't working with psychosis, but there's a lot of interest in psychosis or self states, or then there's dissociation and on and on. So I want to ask you to think about this as a clinician, because I think you believe it's a shame that psychosis is good enough for theory but not good enough for treatment.
Right.
And so I'll tell you what I want you to do, and you know, I can't always get what you want, but you know, so if you could offer the field in America, you know, an interpretation, an intervention that might shake loose what looks like our reluctance to work with psychosis. Because in the book, you do say it is not the insurance companies, it's not the loss of the brick mother, it's not, you know, the insurance companies, but there's something else going on, right, in American psychoanalysis. So what can you give this a shot?
Yeah. So you're challenging me. No, I think this was one of my first points of entry into this whole project, because in the mid-late 90s, the Relational School of American Psychoanalysis became very popular in Israel, and mainly among psychoanalytically oriented psychotherapists, less so among the psychoanalysts from the Israeli society, which is a little bit like the Royal Society, you know, they're very exclusive. So this was the kind of contemporary literature that we were reading. And I was, as you said, I was surprised to find how much interest there was in this primitive parts of the personality, the psychotic, and how little clinical intervention they actually showed with psychotic people, because I was always trying also to see whether they report cases. And I found in this specific thought collective of the relational school, and specifically in the publication in this Psychoanalytic Dialogues, as you said, that, you know, there were all possible psychotic parts and elements and defenses and dynamics, but the schizophrenic, if they were, they were the mothers of the patient. So I thought that I was witnessing some kind of a return to some form of the seduction theory, you know, that it's always about some bad parent out there, or right. Even worse, the schizophrenogenic mother.
Right. Real trauma. Yeah.
Yes. Like something. And I know that you feel my pain, because you're a big believer in the death instinct too.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel your pain.
But there is something inside, you know. So I think that bottom line, the psychotic schizophrenic patients need, I think, what Henry Ray called the brick mother. But and it can be an asylum, and it can be a practice, it can be a house, it doesn't matter. But that it allows this kind of protective frame for both the analyst and the patient to explore this kind of world, you know, to be able to transform what is still in you know, in forms of you know, unthought, undigestible, unmentalized, and that it needs to be done, or it can only be done basically in an atmosphere that understands that that we cannot come to treat these patients from a megalomaniac place with too much of grandiose expectations, but to understand and accept that, you know, they live on these primitive edges, as Ogden says, and that we would be there with them in the in these trenches if we want to be able to offer some kind of meaning to this catastrophe. So the point that I make is that it's good not only for patients and for analysts, but also for the survival of psychoanalysis, you know, for it to survive as a theory that still produces knowledge. Mm-hmm. Because there is something, and I know that you know that because I read your piece with meeting this amazing patients, but that they challenge us, you know, they challenge us not only as individual, but also they shake us, you know, they shake our defenses, they are challenging our thought collectives, mm-hmm. they force us to think. Mm-hmm. And we know that, you know, whatever is repressed is coming back, or whatever is split off becomes persecutory.
Right.
It comes to bite us from behind.
We say here in America, the chickens have come home to roost.
Okay.
It's actually Malcolm X.
Okay. Yeah. So that's a good reference.
It is a good reference. Yeah. We're in good company.
We are. So I think that, you know, if psychoanalysts want this profession to survive as psychoanalysis and not as anything else, they have to become specialists in this area of catastrophic anxieties, you know, of death and violence and destruction. And it's only by treating such patients that they can learn how to do that. Mm-hmm. So it's both, you know, helping the individual patient from this internal inferno, and also society, because we see what happens when madness is not is not treated.
Right.
We all hope to wake up on Wednesday,
yeah,
and survive the catastrophe.
Right.
But also, it's really from. You know, from a place of loving and psychoanalysis as a field, as a discipline that creates knowledge, and that is, for me, feels like in a long slumber, you know, that needs mm-hmm. to be, as you say, shake loose or awaken.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love how you end the book, you know, with and what you're saying now, because it really made complete sense to me that if, as a field, we disavow, split off, whatever you want to put it, but mm-hmm. I would consider the death instinct, the parts of ourselves that are more destructive of self and others. And instead, we imagine, again, it seems so American to think that the something outside of me made me this way.
Right.
You know, that we're a culture that likes to blame and point outside. But meanwhile, you know, everybody's got a gun. You know,
yes.
Like it's like, well, you know, so what, so how do we as analysts, what don't we want to see? What don't American analysts particularly want to see about destructive aggression, and the extreme, you know, living on, you know, sort of extreme psychic experiences that are, it's disconcerting, but it's also human.
Yes.
It's yes. Human, you know, loving love is easy. You know, hating hate is easy,
mm-hmm.
but ending up someplace else beyond loving love and hating hate is, you know, where, I mean, that's where analysts, I think that's where we have to do our work.
Yeah. Yeah. Live with this kind of tension.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, my dear, this has been terrific. I mean, really, really good. I think that you have taught people, the listeners have probably learned a tremendous amount. And so from New Books in Psychoanalysis, we want to thank you for talking with us. We look forward to your book on Klein and her marginalization in America. And to the listeners, thanks again for loving and listening to New Books in Psychoanalysis. We love you all back. And for now, bye-bye.